Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEFCON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEFCON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEFCON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
So it is possible to have fun at the MGM Grand. Okay, well, our next speaker is Dale Thackeray. There's much confusion about her because she seems to change jobs every several years. If you don't realize it, last year she outdrank all the hackers. It was really embarrassing. So this year we've matched her tonight, the showdown. But, well, I'll just let her introduce herself. She's actually human and really nice.
Don't clap until you hear what I have to say. I hate being tied to a podium, but it looks like this is the only really suitable way to do this because we're going to do questions and answers. I had hoped to maybe offer in one of these breaks or as part of this PowerPoint presentation on wiretaps that I give to cops so that they'll understand what the wiretap law really does cover. But, you know, thinking about it, yeah, I change jobs every 5 years or so, usually right around election time. Our county right now is really broke. We're taking days off without pay. There's a budget deficit, and I only have one computer. It's nice, okay. But at the last minute, I just couldn't bring myself to bring it up here. It's a laptop, and I thought it might not go home in the same condition in which it arrived. So I don't have my PowerPoint presentation now. Jeff had told me, I have the disk, but Jeff had told me that someone else was going to have a PowerPoint-equipped computer available. So if anybody does, let me know, and we can do this. I'm not going to try and give any kind of rebuttal to the distinguished Mr. Zimmerman, but I do have a few comments or reactions to some of the things he said. First of all, you have to look at privacy in a historical context. I know that just really rubs a lot of you the wrong way because you think that anything that doesn't have program code to it is not worth learning. But history occasionally can be fun. Go back to the origin of documents. I'm giving some talks now to corporate security types on the death of documents. And at the end of this presentation today, I'm going to ask you folks to help us. This may come as a surprise, but you might even decide it's an intriguing challenge. In corporate security, in business, in government, in daily life, to help prevent the death of documents. And I'll explain that at the end. Why do I talk about death of documents? Well, it's true that our mail was pretty private, but as long as there have been people sealing envelopes for privacy, there have been people seeming them open. And usually, numerically, not always the government. We need to see privacy in a historical context, and we need to see it not as us versus the government, but as the whole social network. Where are privacy invasions, unfair ones, bad ones, ones we don't approve of happening? What can we do to prevent that? We had letters a long time ago, and what did we have? The seal ring and the wax and the sticking the hot wax under the envelope to make sure that people would not read your sealed letter, and you had your personal seal, password, if you would. And it sealed your document, your parchment, and it got delivered by state messenger, maybe by the King's Post. And for the most part, documents were secure. For the most part, they still are today, whether you send them electronically or through the post office. Is the government a real threat to read your mail, you personally? No, come on guys, life is too short. I read a lot of your electronic mail. You have to pay me to do this, okay? I don't do this on purpose because it's not that entertaining. The government does not, there are exceptions, but as a whole, the government does not have an interest and certainly does not have the resources to read your mail in whatever form. There is too much of it. How many million people do we have in America, and how many messages in whatever form do they generate a day? I have no idea. But the government is not big enough to read that and doesn't have a reason to want to. And when does the government want to read your mail? Same reason your suspicious spouse might want to read your mail. Same reason your teachers, your employers, your neighbors occasionally might snoop into your life. Some kinds of information interest us and we pursue them, whatever position we find ourselves in. Well, back when we had parchment letters going, you could have privacy. You had an expectation, but you also had people out there reheating the wax and finding clever ways to get into your sealed parchment and then reseal it so you wouldn't know it had been read. Face-to-face communication, unfortunately, this is where I really disagree with Mr. Zimmerman, never was secure. If you ever speak to someone, you take the risk that they will pass on what you said. You take the risk that they will distort what you said. They will lie to or innocently alter. They will lie to other people about what you said or innocently alter what you said. And you may have to answer for that, fairly or not, what's your response. I didn't say that. Wait, I thought that was in confidence. Communications have never been secure. Occasionally, we have invented a technology that gave us an increased expectation of communication privacy. What was one of the first ones? The telegram. That was the first form of electronic communication widely used by the masses. And it was really neat. When it was going beep, beep, beep over that little wire, a very limited number of people could hear it and translate it. But when you sent a telegram, you were vulnerable to the key operator you dictated it to, who keyed it in. You were vulnerable to anyone down the line who knew the code. And you were vulnerable to the people at the other end who transcribed it, and to the little guy on the yellow, you know, with the yellow envelope on the messenger bicycle who delivered it. You had, however, better expectation of privacy that way than you had sending an open postcard, for example. Then we get to the phone. You know, a lot of people are very exercised about telephone privacy, and I'm sure I'll get some questions on digital telephony. The phone was never private. I can still remember when, in order to call my friend on Chappaquiddick, I would have to dictate the operator's routing path to the operator who didn't make those calls often enough and did not know the secret code. It wasn't anything secret about it. It was just how to get my call from here to there. Because although everyone else at that time in America was converting to direct dialing, they hadn't done it in the rural areas like Chappaquiddick. Well, think about phones. Those old 40s movies, you know, Mabel sitting in her living room in the small town with the switchboard and the plugs and the headsets. You never had any privacy in a phone call. Those were party lines. I still have a friend in New Hampshire who has a party line. She has no privacy on her phone. The switchboard operator and everyone else on that party line could hear everything you said, and usually did. Neighbors are like that. We started having an expectation of telephone privacy when we got to automated switching and direct dial. And now there's a lot of complaining that the government wants to preserve the ability in those extremely rare, numerically, situations where a particular call becomes of interest and they want to know where does it go or what do they say. I absolutely agree that communications, for the most part, should be private. And I think, and I know some of you will disagree with me, the vast majority of communications done through the telephone, they are private. However, I do disagree with who's invading that privacy most. Have you ever been to the spy shop in your neighborhood? If you live in any size urban area, you've got one. They may call it something else. I am not allowed to own, as a law enforcement person, or operate most of the equipment that is sold over the counter. Okay? There is no legitimate use for a lot of that equipment in our spy shop in Arizona. We've got several of them. The only use that can be made of it is to invade someone else's privacy. And by that, I'm not talking about tape recorders or things that you can legally use in many states. Tape recording a conversation with someone you're speaking to is an ethical question in many states, and certainly under the federal law. It's not illegal if you're a party to tape record that conversation. But some of the other equipment, the bugs, and the various egregious electronic devices, we can't use. Without supervision of a court, we have to have a very high threshold of probable cause, previous investigation. We have to justify to the court why a less intrusive means than listening to a phone conversation won't work. And we have to have court supervision at every inch of the way. And many of you may not realize this, but when a judge authorizes a wiretap, eavesdropping on a phone line, perhaps bugging a motel room, when a judge authorizes this, after that initial threshold has been met, it's very unusual law enforcement technique. The judge personally supervises constantly every step of the way. No arrest has been made yet. This is like a search warrant, but it's a search warrant with the judge asking questions. It's personally supervised. And judges routinely say, you know, I don't think this is getting anywhere, kill it. They tell us, kill it, your authorization's over. We don't make that decision, the judge does. Now, we could argue we want it longer, we want it shorter, we want more, we want less. The point is, the court is making that decision, not the investigating officer. Why do we want to preserve this right to occasionally select one of the zillions of phone calls a day and find out what's happened during it? Well, I speak for law enforcement today, but if there are any phone security people here, their feelings are probably going to be pretty hurt by a couple of the stories I'm about to tell you. I don't like having to deal with a family on a Saturday night when there's a kidnapping and tell them, as we might have to do in the future, as I had to do because of one uncooperative phone company one night, I'm sorry, we can't trace that call. We can't find her. The phone company, by law, has to assist us. And they won't. It's when it's your kid, okay? It's your sister that you start understanding privacy. It's really important, but so is human life. And Mr. Zimmerman's got a lovely idealistic view of our society. And I was so interested in this that I wrote this down pretty much verbatim, I think. He said that we live in a peacetime, benign environment in the U.S. We do. There aren't any Russian armies invading at the moment, but we do have Arab terrorists, and we have a lot of armed criminals, and unfortunately, whether they're politically motivated, as I believe the tower bombers obviously were, or whether they're personally motivated, bad things happen out there, I mean really bad things, and not in the abstract. And somehow, there has to be a decision made, not by me and not by you, but by our society, our community as a whole. Where are we going to balance those scales so that we have the maximum available privacy for the maximum number of people, and so that we're also not held hostage by the occasional ruthless predator who doesn't play by our rules and doesn't respect the rules that we've all agreed on? I think you're going to see a lot more seriously bad things happen on the internet just because it is a totally uncontrolled environment. That's going to be our little incubation lab to find out. And I have met, in the course of my work, some really sick, horrible people. And I'd really rather that I not be at their mercy if we take certain technologies and say, nobody, not under court supervision, not the greatest scientist in the world and the greatest civil libertarian working as a team, can get us this answer quickly enough. And part of the reason for that is, no, we do not have an open and declared nuclear arms race at the moment, as Mr. Zimmerman pointed out. It's moved to the streets and the small communities. Controls. If you lose all controls, then what do you have? Do you know how much uranium and all those good things is missing from Russia because they lost control? We are all vulnerable to that. And I'm not saying that somebody's going to show up on the streets of Manhattan again with a bomb and go after any of us personally or happen to hit the neighborhood we live in randomly. That kind of stuff is happening. And there are events in the life of a greater community that require the community or cause the community to say, you know what, we don't like this. We want some accountability, some traceability, some responsibility. And that's when you get regulation. I would hate to see the internet regulated. But if you get enough parents angry enough at their kids being raped, like the boy in San Jose because he met somebody on the wrong board, or just their little kids being insulted through the obscene boards, we have to do a certain amount of self-regulation. or there will be a community move that none of us, I think, today would like. What if we make a decision that, as a society, and we can do this, we've decided as a society that voice communications over the telephone, over cellular phones, whatever, will be absolutely, totally secure. Let's say we come up with some magic. Maybe Mr. Zimmerman's multimedia phone will do it. Nobody can find out what you're saying on the phone. What will happen? In my experience, among the first people to discover the uses, some of them surprising and unexpected, of any new technology are criminals. And I'm not just talking about the kinds of criminals that you and I can debate. Is this a victimless crime? You know, is smoking marijuana bad? I don't do drug cases for the most part. The kinds of cases I get involved in because of what I do are computers, phones, all kinds of, you know, high-tech communications. And I usually get calls for help from groups that deal with really serious crime and don't know this stuff. I think we need to find some compromise and some technical compromise that makes us all secure. As a state prosecutor, I'm fortunately not in the position of having to defend the FBI's handling of the Clipper chip controversy. I don't think anybody could defend the way they handled that. But I'm not advocating it. I'm saying we need some way that if we have to, we can find the phone call and get the information in time to save a life, a town. And whatever that turns out to be is partly up to groups like you. Now, you can continue, those of you who are interested in technological social activism, you could continue expanding the reliability and the usefulness of this technology, and at the same time, do it in a legitimate, socially useful, responsible way. I mentioned the death of documents. We are really not going to take advantage of this technology until we have what we can regard as a reliable record. What did we have for reliable records in the days of seals? Well, we had the seal ring and the ribbon and the king's seal, you know, the seal of the country, the corporate seal on the document. Could those be forged? Sure. But by and large, over time, we found ways in primitive technology to ensure that this document is probably decent and can be relied on. Because people take risks based on what their records and documents say. You would not invest your money in buying a house if the next guy along with a cute piece of paper could take it away from you and you had no way to prove it was yours. It's called the title to land. We've made those fairly secure. We've made phone records in the past were fairly secure. Were there ways in the early days to hack the phone company? Sure. But because the phones had to know where numbers were in order to transmit communication physically over copper wire, there was a way when the death threat came in to find that person before he acted on it, sometimes. If stuff floating mysteriously around the net does not have a physical reality or location, and it does not have what you'd call an audit trail. What that means is the first people who start really abusing the freedom of the net are going to be some of the nastiest people. That's just historically the way it goes. Can we find a way to come up with a reliable document that's going to take a digital signature? Right now, my fellow law enforcement friends and I, knowing that the internet is A, not secure, and it's really hard to identify who really sent you something, if you're suspicious like us, we use the internet for really important sensitive communications like call me. That's the full extent of my email. There's a young man who I don't see here today who's from my jurisdiction who several hacker sort of people have called me up to tell me that young man is bragging that he's been reading my email. He must be bored as hell. The last time you could find me for email was about 3 years ago in the well. We need to be able to say, if we're going to our paperless society, which we can do to avoid killing trees and to make things faster and better for all of us, we need to be able to say, you sent me this document, and I know that, and I can feel confident it's your digital signature. I can rely on this document, this buy order, this let's meet in Vegas for a conference announcement. We've got to have some kind of reliability or accountability put back into our documents the way we had when we had fingerprinting, handwriting, ink analysis, paper analysis. When we had physical documents, there were ways we could test them for the truth. We've got to come up with something like that, or our society will fall behind, I believe, the potential of this technology. Whether you like it or not, people have got to be able to rely on messages and rely on documents. And at some point, your society around you is not going to be sympathetic to some of the paranoid fantasies I see on the hacker boards about, oh, the government's coming to get us. Because, you know, families, if you've been watching the news at all, families are really concerned about crime and feeling vulnerable and unsafe, and they're beginning to get really mad about it. So when you come in and say, we must be private, they're going to agree with you. They don't want their mail opened either. But who's opening their mail? Not me, you. I'm not cruising the net breaking into other people's email. I'm not even doing it with a court order. Life is too short. A lot of you and your friends are. Privacy is a two-edged sword. You can't say, my stuff is private, by God, and I'm going to go with Zimmerman, I'm going to contribute to his legal defense fund. Good. But then I guess you would never be guilty yourself of trespassing into someone else's system without their permission, would you? You same people who are so strong advocates of privacy that you want absolutely unbreakable communication, why does yours need to be unbreakable totally if you're not breaking into anyone else's? I'm sorry? Okay. So you're saying you don't have the responsibility to respect anyone else's privacy? Okay, the comment was that the gentleman was responding to what I just said, and he said he is not a law enforcement agent held to be what should be the higher standards of law enforcement. That's true. My challenge to some of you who are active and vocal on the net about we must take radical steps to protect our privacy are some of the very same people who do not respect other people's privacy. Now, that, as you correctly pointed out, is an ethical question for citizens who are not in an official capacity. Yeah, let's throw this over for more comments or questions.
Do you really think that the inconsistency of some people's position on the privacy issue underlines the tenability of an extreme position on the Fourth Amendment?
Well, we're kind of in a mixture of areas here. The Fourth Amendment deals with search and seizure. A lot of the privacy issues involving computer and communications technology are statutory. They come under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986, or for people like Mr. Markoff, under the Privacy Act that relates specifically to press. And one of the confusions between the Fourth Amendment says that the government must have probable cause to go do a search, and the Fourth Amendment talks about expectations of privacy. When does the government need to be aware that you have an expectation of privacy? Not when the government agent is talking to you face-to-face, but certainly if two people are alone in a hotel room, the government is not supposed to be listening without having jumped all the hoops that those cases from the constitutional amendment and the statutes require. Now, the wiretap statute is very specific, and one of the warnings I want to make sure you all understand is that it is not a regulation that adversely affects my life. I mean, is it inconvenient? Is it hard to meet the standards? Sure. Does it make my job harder? Sure. I like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, though, because it is so strict that if I can meet those standards, I'm fine. What a lot of you don't understand is that statute regulates you personally. And whether you're in the government or not, if you break that law, say reading someone else's email without their permission, you have committed a felony that they can personally sue you for individually. See, the Fourth Amendment says the government must do this or must not do that. The wiretap statute says each and every one of us individually is responsible for meeting these standards and is liable if we don't. Yeah.
I'm a little bit more of a business person than I am. But, you know, I'm really fond about the Christians.
Yeah. The question related, the gentleman gave us, for those of you in the back, a description of his experience in business and the importance of his communications being secure on networks because they're vulnerable to every place the message passes through. When, in an age when money is not, the Pennsylvania legislature used to think the money was gold bricks and they drove it up and down the streets between banks to balance the books, you know, it hasn't been true for a long time. And when money is little magnetic things floating around the world at warp speed between banks, obviously secure network communications is critical, and he was saying he believes encryption is crucial for that. I agree. I don't have any qualm with that whatsoever. I think that we have, for either our personal business or our national security reasons, a lot of things that need to be very secure. At what point, though, as a society, are we going to say that even if that means that people will regularly die or places will be bombed or other bad things will happen because we can't get into the communication, at what level are we willing to drop that balance and say we can tolerate that? And part of the problem is that until it is actively personally affecting you from the other side, it's hard to see the other side's perspective. I think what we will come up with is what we've done for phones. The technology will make it harder to eavesdrop. The laws and the privacy, you know, there's a balancing kind of act and a shakedown. Our first wiretap law was in 1968. We had phones till century previous. And what we did is we kind of sorted out how the technology worked and how the community worked, and then we said, you know, maybe we ought to tell the cops they can't just go do this. Let's make it harder and make the judge supervise. We're going to do the same thing digitally on the net with all these neat multimedia things. And one of the things, before I get off the track, because I really wanted to show this to you, don't just aim at us, okay? I think we should all hold corporations to a far higher standard than we have. We are being economically raped in our individual privacy, and they're making the money. And they lie to us regularly. One of my favorite games recently, I'm seriously thinking of holding a contest on this, is I get both Time and Newsweek, and I compare the photos in them on the breaking stories. I've caught them out really badly a few times. This is an ad that came out for United Airlines, and it's obviously the thing that drew me to it is, you know those Benson and Hedges ads where people are sitting out on the wing of the plane smoking? Well, if you look at this photo, this is heartwarming. American employees taking over their employer. Isn't this wonderful? And then you start looking at it and you think, wow, how did they get this picture together so fast? And then you go, oh, that's interesting. The same fat lady in pink is here and here and here and here. This is like, you know, find Wally in the museum or something. If you look at this thing and you start, I didn't even get out a magnifying glass. You start looking at this, they lied to me. And there is no requirement that they tell us when they are visually lying to us. The computer is the best forgery tool ever invented. I don't have to tell you guys that. And this is an outrage. Now, there was a picture I had from Time and Newsweek two weeks ago, where Barry Diller and the QVC CBS buyout, it was going to be wonderful, right? Newsweek and Time had the same photos against the same backdrop, except one of them, the digital forgery was so bad you could get seasick because your brain is used to interpreting photos and paintings with a sense of perspective. And they had done a Mobius strip of perspective here, and you kind of went like this looking at the picture because your brain kept trying to adjust, and it was like, can't focus, can't focus. They should have to tell us when they are lying to us visually. They should have to tell us when facts and statistics, they being everyone who uses these, not just government, not just corporations. You can't rely on anything you see in print. You can't rely on anything that looks like a photo. And until we come back to a reliability, some way to authenticate this stuff, what are we having? Information anarchy, but not of a good kind. Yeah, gentleman right here.
Thank you.
Okay, in what instance do you think that is happening without eventual notice to you, and who do you think is doing it? Yeah, you don't necessarily... Okay, let me put it this way. When I get a call from a cop saying, help, help, we think there's a kidnapping, can you get the phone company to help? I don't immediately call up the bad guy and say, excuse me, we're about to trace your calls, be nice, be cooperative, don't loop. You know, we don't do that right away. But if we do one of the things that requires notice, the judge will tell us when, and we do have to notify everyone who has been the subject of a wiretap. That was my question to you. What is it that makes you think that they can do, they, whoever you're accusing, can do that now legally? Well, the point is, if it's the government's doing it, you do have to be notified. It's all your friends who aren't telling you. That's not true. Under the Communications Privacy Act, the Wiretap Act, if as a law enforcement officer I caused an interception of your email to occur, let's say you're on the well, and we do an interception somehow of your mail going to and from the well, you have to get notice. You may not get it right away, but you have to get notice if they intercept a protected communication. Not all communications are protected. No. There are warrants, search warrants, valid court-approved warrants, where you receive delayed notice, just as you would with a wiretap. I'm sorry? I assume some of them must. We saw it on the Rodney King case. Does that make them the standard for the rest of police? Of course not. Do the hackers who break the law make them heroes for your group? I hope not. I can't hear that last part. Well, I'm sure you are worried about it, but I think your worries are aimed in a little bit of the wrong direction. Of the cases of known, now I'm not talking about the national security spooks, okay? Those guys, I don't know what they do, and that would make it very interesting for all of us. I'm talking about traditional, you know, street cop type law enforcement looking for state, local, and federal crimes of whatever type. I'm not talking about people worrying about spook transmissions. That's a whole different game, and it plays by different constitutional rules. But standard law enforcement, I know of only a couple instances in the whole history of the regulation of wiretaps where things have been done wrong. And part of the reason for that is the court scrutiny that was put in 1968. Because you don't have rogue cops going off doing things. Now, I have found butt sets with alligator clips in about half of the locations I have searched for hacker evidence, and there is no legal way for them to tap onto anyone but their own. But in terms of paranoia that I was talking about on the net, it really isn't true. Wiretaps are incredibly expensive. Now, we might question the judgment of the individual officer who wants to do a wiretap in a particular case. I do that all the time. It's part of my job. But to get wiretap authorization is really very time-consuming, very labor-intensive, and very expensive. And it's hard, because the judges are looking over your shoulder. I mean, they'll come down to the wiretap site and look at your equipment and make sure there is no security leak that they can see, maybe, because of the privacy of the people whose interceptions, whose communications are being intercepted. Yes. No, now see, this is what's wonderful and why I say some of the paranoia is a little misplaced. By the same law that regulates law enforcement and requires judicial supervision, the gentleman over here whose business life depends on networks, if he's the communication provider, the service provider, he does not have to go to a judge in order to run trap and trace and pen register equivalents on his PBX. And what's more, if you believe some of the people who interpret the Communications Privacy Act, no corporation providing the service has to give you any warning that they are intercepting your voice or phone mail. Now, voice is different because it's got some specific stuff in the act, and it'll depend on the state they're in. But as far as email, if they're the communication service provider, they have a very strong argument under that statute that anything you send through their service, they can read if they need to for security and fraud purposes.
But if we're using strong encryption, that's the
point. Yep. There's nothing wrong with using encryption. Sure, that's fine. No, I'm saying there's nothing wrong with using encryption, but some of what is driving the let's all use it stuff, it's really just not happening out there in the same way that I read it on the net. It doesn't hurt. Feel free. You have my blessing. I don't think anybody's going to be taking back in Clipper. I'm not. But I mean, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. The bad guys are going to be the first people to abuse any technology. That's kind of like a law of life. What? Because the vast majority of communications involved that someone might want to trace or learn the content of for a legitimate purpose, one we could all agree was legitimate, the vast majority of those are going to be things that are produced. Like, for example, PGP is really neat, and it's all over the place. Well, if there were a backdoor to PGP, I think the government folks and some of the people who are scared of how bad this could get are saying is there a way we can find that we can get access on those rare occasions when we got it, and we'd all agree we got it. Yeah, well, they used to think DES was uncrackable, too. Every technology gets overtaken by the next wave, okay? Sure. There is never going to be totally secure private communications. You know why? Because the people doing the communicating are people. We're messy, sloppy, lazy, and we hate doing stuff perfectly. Yeah, kidnapping. What about that little Polly class girl who eventually died? What if her parents and the cops had known, over here, that guy is on a bulletin board? Would we want to be able to find out where he was? I think most of us would vote to do this. That's not true. We've had several cases of that. Part of the Constitution includes your right to the pursuit of happiness, you know, and sometimes that requires help from your neighbors. That's all I'm saying. You got it. Hey, there are days you can't make a phone call out of New York City when somebody cuts the line, too. No technology is totally reliable. The argument, I think some of the arguments here are that the danger of being able, for example, having a backdoor in PGP, the danger of being able to get into what we want to be a secure communication is greater than the danger of leaving it totally secure. And that's what I'm telling you, society is going to shake it down, play with it, and work it out over time, as we have with every other communications technology. you may want to, but you guys and the net users and the serious techies are not going to be the only people who vote on the issue. And I think if you look to the future, you can either be part of a useful solution we can all live with as a good compromise, or you can take extreme positions because the rest of America would say, fine, you're wrong, we're voting you out of office, and you can have totally secure encryption technology, but just as some of the folks said in answer to Mr. Zimmerman, there are countries in which passing of an encrypted document will get you in just as much trouble as if somebody doesn't like what you say. So, we have the First Amendment, other countries do not, and don't forget that. And I want to stress what somebody said over here, I think someone who said, was talking about Yugoslavia. This is really fun to play with at home, okay? You know, this is one of these let's try anarchy at home kids, because America's a safe place to do that. Please, when you are conducting some of these debates or when you're having little pranks with each other, please be very careful about your fellows in some of the countries you're screwing with, okay? Because we are gradually coming up with cooperation treaties between nations. The problem is, if we have to send one of you to Germany, or worse yet, to some obscure third world country, under one of those treaties, because they fight for you and they get you, we are not going to be able to protect your rights when you physically are in jeopardy in another country. Start with Singapore. Now, when you are doing some of the things that America kind of tolerates at home, like time bombs and a few other little things like that, remember that other countries do not find it funny. And in some places, they will cut off your hand for what you get away with here. So just really, not so much for your own safety. I'm not kidding about this. Be very careful with your fellows in other countries. They can be swayed by the air of tolerance that they see on the net and in America, and it's not safe for them to do some of these things at home. And it's not safe for you, for their sakes, to send them some things. So if they want to take the risk, that's fine, but don't do it to them. Yes?
Yeah, I can say kind of.
Well, I won't take a photograph now without seeing the original film, and even that's not fail-safe, but it's somehow. The law is desperate for a truly perfect, reliable authentication of electronic documents. If you can come up with one that works, you will be rich, because everybody is desperate for this. Companies that pay a fortune for their electronic or optical storage of documents would love to get rid of all that paper, and they can't. In fact, in some cases, the historical archives laws prevent us in government from getting rid of paper, even if the original was magnetically created. So if you can come up with an absolute, authenticable, preferably non-forgeable digital signature, you'll be rich and we'll all be happy. In the greater issues, the law will never catch up with technology. That's not the job of the law. The law is there to be the encoded sentiment of a community that has wrestled with an issue and come to a conclusion. I'll be around for the rest of the day. Unfortunately, I got bumped out of my hotel room tonight like a lot of you, so I have to leave on an evening plane, but I'll be glad to take any more questions, but I'm way out of time now, and I know there are several more, so we can do this during the break, okay?